the transmission lines. That's reasonably complete. Nice, lots of nice illustrations. Looks like the article goes on for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pages. Looks like a well-done article, starting on page 30. The benefit of open wire transmission line, which is tremendous, is something that we never talk about enough. Almost all of us have fallen in love with coax, and we think there's no other kind of transmission line. Under certain situations where you want high performance with broadband antennas covering multiple bands, there's a lot to be said about open wire transmission line. Even though the installation is a little bit more persnickety, it's not an expensive transmission line, but properly treating it when you install it does represent some unusual problems of how do you support it, not putting it too close to other metallic objects and so on. Let me drop it. In most cases, a piece of coax cable, you can lay it against a piece of ductwork, you can curve it around in various directions, you can put it through holes in the wall, and it works like a charm. You can't do any of those things with an open wire line. You don't put it near other metallic objects, you don't make sharp bends, you support it very carefully, and so you have to give it some tender loving care to use it, but when you do, you get some huge benefits of extremely low loss, extremely high standing wave ratio tolerance of the transmission line, and certain kinds of antennas work a hell of a lot better with open wire than they do with coax. So that's part of what's being indicated now by Tim, if I understand correctly. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this subject before I go to my next guy on the list, who I've been keeping waiting an awful long time? K2RIW listening.
More comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Tim.
Actually, a follow-up of my questions a long time ago, just how to measure the, the balanced output on the tuner. So if you want to get into that, maybe later. I don't want to keep the other person on the list waiting. So if you want to get into that later, we can talk about that. Over.
Yeah, that's essentially the quality of a balance, which Mike, WY2U, Professor Mike was giving us some information on that. And any further information on that, we should discuss that. Right now, I've got Joe and Vito on the list. We've got to handle them. We'll go to the mailbag, we'll go to the SpaceNet, and then with the time left over, if you can stay up that late, Tim, we'll cover that information. If not, I'll put your number one on the runway next week, if you know what I mean. So we've got to move on, and I thank you. See, now, the next guy was Joe, W2RYY. He asked these nice, simple questions that give us no grief at all. I'm pulling his leg. Go ahead, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the second half.
W2RYY, I have a question and a comment, and if I didn't make them difficult, I wouldn't be KB gray matter in the pink, would I?
You gotta keep that stirring the pot. It's okay. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. The question and the comment is both about digital television. The question is actually pretty simple, probably can be answered by your broadcast engineer, and that is a couple of days ago, in fact it was Friday night, very late Friday night, I picked up on RF Channel 12, a carrier coming out of New York City, I checked the azimuth bearing, and it was identified as 12-10, and had the call letters WNBC. And it was showing the same program material as RF-28, which is also WNBC. Any comments on that? And I checked about 3-4 hours later after, I think it was showing like the late show. I checked about a couple hours later, and it was gone.
I hope Eric is still with us. KE2EJ, if you're there, and if so, if need be, we'll repeat the question. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, he might have had to leave us, and maybe he'll come back a little bit later. He has talked about low-power TV stations. There's quite a series of them. Maybe this is a low-power TV station. And so, channel 12-10. I'm going to go look for that. I hope it's a reasonably strong signal. I'd like to see if I also get it, WNBC. And you're saying it was identical to the normal over-the-air WNBC H1, is that what you're saying, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet?
Yes, Dick, it had the same exact program material as on RF-28, which is what WNBC is, so 4-1. It only lasted for a couple hours. I checked later, much later on in the evening, and the carrier was gone. It had slightly less signal strength than channel 11 and channel 13, as far as the indicator on my tuner. Okay, so that's as far as questions. So if you don't have any broadcast engineer here, I guess you can't answer questions. It's not on the air now. I checked it earlier today, and even this evening, it's not there. And my comment I have on the same subject is, I did some measurements on what it takes to actually interfere with the television signal coming into my converter. As far as levels, and I got some, actually got some interesting results. Because I mean, you've talked about that in the past, but I discovered something rather interesting.
Yeah, as of last week, Eric made it fairly sure, clear that to get good, reliable digital television over-the-air reception, you need 27 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio. Now, that's probably if you've got broadband noise across the whole channel. If you've got a distinct CW signal that you're putting into the channel and you slowly wave it across the channel, I'll bet you the numbers are going to be very, very different than exactly 27 dB, particularly if that CW signal happens to be on the pilot tone frequency versus the edge of the band, so to speak. So I'll bet you there's a complicated curve of injected CW signal frequency and amplitude that gives the grief. And I presume your threshold of grief is where the bit error rate on your digital converter climbed to the point where either the picture starts locking up, the sound goes away, or it gives you the indication of weak signal. W2RYY, there's some guesses on my part. RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet, wait for the beeps.
Hello, Delta 2, Bravo Delta, with a comment on channel 12.
Yeah, let's pick that one up first. Blank 2, Bravo Delta. I probably should know you. Give me the full call, your name, and then your channel call information. And do you work in broadcast? Go right ahead, sir.
Good evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. This is Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. My name is John. No, I don't work in the broadcast industry, but I do know the channel 12. The two tests that are being conducted right now are being conducted from the top of the World Trade Center. They're running some tests, I believe, for the next month during the overnight period. Over.
That's darn good information, John. I know we've got a very fancy tower on the new World Trade Center. And how many of the broadcast stations that reestablish themselves at the Empire State Building, how many of them are going to switch over to the World Trade Center and pay the higher tariff? I'm guessing it's higher tariff. Is an interesting question. At one time, we thought everybody's going to go over to the new World Trade Center. Then again, many of these broadcast stations and networks have made a substantial investment with new transmission lines, new power cables, new antennas, new towers, and whatever, at Empire. And therefore, I am guessing for the time being, a number of the stations, maybe even the PBS station, for instance, is going to be reluctant to switch over to World Trade because that represents a substantial investment. And the bang for dollar, so to speak. I mean, are you suddenly going to have twice the range when you transmit from World Trade as opposed to Empire? The answer is no. And so with the megabucks that has to go into that move, I'm not convinced that everybody's going to do it right away, so to speak. So tell us what you think about those subjects, John. KD2PD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD. My guess is that the higher altitude is going to give them better coverage out to the fringe areas. I happen to be sort of in a fringe area. I'm about 39 miles south of World Trade. I haven't tried picking up the signals yet, but I might give it a try over the next week. That they have an experimental antenna up there which is rotatable, and they are rotating it. I believe they're basically beaming towards the north because there is a channel 12 in Philadelphia, so they're going to try to avoid interference with that, but I believe they're aiming the antenna in different directions, running at different power levels, and the tests are being conducted on RF channel 12 and RF channel 32. As far as increasing coverage, I think they're kind of limited to doing that, so my guess is the higher height would allow them to run lower power and get a better lower bit error rate, better saturation over their current coverage area. That's just a guess. K2RIW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, very fine, John. John's in Seagirt. He's 59 miles from me in central Long Island at Huntington, and a bearing of 218. And you're quite far south of me, and you're a good distance out. That extra altitude of the World Trade Center is going to help. But if you study altitude versus range, it's not a linear relationship, even though World Trade is, I should know, 1776 feet as opposed to 1,200 feet. I guess it's another 500-600 feet higher. As such, it's 500 feet of extra altitude on top of 1,200. Not going to double your range, absolutely not. If I had to make a rough guess, it's going to make a 15% or 20% increase in range. And the total number of people at that range watching over the television is so small that the investment is going to be a little bit difficult to justify. Let me give you an example of that. In Huntington Township, there's a small town called Dix Hills that I live in. Dix Hills has 25,000 people. One human being in Dix Hills has a operating aerial that's getting over-the-air television reception. One human being. And I've looked at most of those residents. I've driven up and down those streets from time to time looking for antennas. I appear to be the only one. As such, and I'm 30-some-odd miles from the Empire State Building. So most people have given up on over-the-air broadcast television if you're not in the metro area near New York City, near Empire. When you're out to my area, they just given it up. Well, I can see a number of things going on simultaneously. One, a zillion channels, pay-per-view, they want all kinds of sports, so they're on some kind of cable or satellite system. That's a big factor. But they could be getting, in my case, television from quite a number of states, quite a number of channels, without paying anything for it. To me, it's just a price thing. I've got towers. I can put antennas on towers. Therefore, I like watching over-the-air broadcast. I don't like paying for it. I didn't pay for it in the past. Why should I pay for it now? Yes, I'm a dinosaur. So the total number of over-the-air broadcast increase in audience you're going to get for that extra altitude, in my opinion, is a rather small percentage. It's going to take you quite a few megabucks to do that. And so I'm guessing not a great number of channels are going to do it. Do you have a guess from what you know, John, as to have any of the... Let me drop it. Have any of the major broadcast concerns and major networks, to your knowledge, have they said, yes, we're about to make a major commitment for the World Trade Center. We're going to put $10 million into it. We're going to put a 50-kilowatt television broadcast station with all the antennas. We're going to do that. Have you heard of a specific network saying something like those words? KD2BD, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD. I haven't heard those words, but there must be something. These tests that they're running, I believe they're running the tests so they can gather some data and have some numbers so they can make some proposals, I would imagine. I can tell you this. Back in the analog days when broadcasting went from World Trade Center to the Empire State Building, I'm 45 and a half miles from the Empire State Building, and it made a difference. I was getting snow on many DHS channels I've never got before. So the World Trade Center, to me, is about 5 miles closer, yet its height does make a difference where I am. And by the way, you know, in order to double the range, you've got to quadruple your height. So, yeah, that 500 feet difference doesn't sound like much, but when you're on the, you know, when it makes the difference between something that's below your horizon and kind of elevates a little bit more, sometimes it makes a noticeable difference. And those extra antennas they have that are causing you a little bit of a problem out towards the east, I think they're panel antennas that are facing towards Brooklyn, which are giving you some with multipath or inter-symbol, distortion due to those two, interference on those two antennas. Maybe those antennas will no longer be required if they get a higher, a single antenna up higher. And there's also talk about other buildings going up in New York, which could cause other reflections in multipath. So maybe that higher elevation will actually somewhat pay off, even for the folks who are a lot closer than I am. K2RIW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Digital television really suffers from its intolerance of multipath. Multipath, which gives you inter-symbol distortion. In other words, you've got this digital code coming directly to you by direct line of sight, and a little bit of that signal bounces off the water tower, has a slightly longer path, comes into your receiving antenna, and that delayed signal is shifted in time. The digits are shifted in time compared to the main signal, and if those digits shifted in time are not 27 dB weaker, there's a good chance that your normal digital television demodulator is going to go bonkers and say, I give up, the bit error rate's too high, I can't lock onto that signal, and it gives you a weak signal indication. Also, when you study, I can't think of the name of it, there's a mathematical process. It's not Rayleigh phase, it's another mathematical process. When it comes to how close is the multipath, in other words, if the object giving me multipath is a mile from my house, it's going to be significant. If the object giving me multipath is a mile from the broadcast station, very difficult for that to give me any grief. When you study the way propagation works, and you look at these football-shaped curves of group delay distortion, amplitudes, it's amplitude versus location. The nearby multipath object is a hell of a lot more important to whether or not you've got grief. Also, impulse noise is a vulnerable thing to digital television reception. Therefore, channel 12, which is a VHF channel, is going to be more vulnerable than a UHF channel. So for long-range transmission, that might not be the best way to go. Let me drop it. To the people in the so-called fringe area, I used to be in a strong signal area when it comes to analog television. I'm in a definite fringe area when it comes to digital television. And so the local things that I've got, trees, buildings, houses, water towers, and so on, are the things that are going to give me a lot of grief, and therefore, if I have a rotator on my television aerial, don't rotate the antenna to get the strongest signal from the Empire State Building. You rotate the antenna so that the strongest multipath object in your neighborhood a mile away falls into one of the notches of your antenna, and all of a sudden you can clean digital reception. So it behaves differently. And so channel 12 may not be the most desirable place to be on this new channel that's running these experiments. Bunch of opinions I've just given you, John. KD2BD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet from KD2BD. Well, they're running on channel 12 because it's fairly vacant in the New York area. And also channel 32, tests are being conducted as well for the same reason. So it just needs a simplest kind of sort of basis so they can run these tests. And by the way, you probably already are aware that channel 3 went on the air from Four Times Square, I believe it was October 1st. And back in the analog days, channels 2, 4, and 5 used to get a lot of salt and pepper effect due to power lines arcing during the winter time. And I expected that digital channel 3 to be affected by that impulse noise, but surprisingly, it really hasn't. I'm really, really surprised. It's a very strong signal down here, and even though it's at a lower elevation of Four Times Square, I got to tell you, 3-foot monitoring devices, I really have not been bothered by my impulse noise. I'm really surprised by that. I get lightning noise. I get, noise from drills and electrical appliances. Yeah, but that impulse noise from the power lines, I kind of don't believe that interference went away. I believe it's still there because I hear it on 2 meters as well during the winter. K2RAW on the technical net from KD2BD.
Yeah, I've got channel 3 programmed into my digital converter, but I've now got it in the inactive mode. I've got to go take a look. The channel 3 that's working very well for you down in Seagirt, I'm kind of amazed by that. Does it have channel 3-1-2-3-4, or is it only 3-1? I mean, if they've got very few other sub-channels, and all of the energy is devoted to that one channel, maybe there's a way you can do that to give less vulnerability. And what kind of programming is on that? How many hours a day are they on? So I haven't been smart enough to look for that one. Back to you on that one, John. KD2BD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the technical net from KD2BD. I don't think the number of sub-channels matters. You're still getting a certain bit rate from the transmitter regardless of how many sub-channels there are. So the number of sub-channels doesn't affect the range or the error rate or anything. Channel 3 has had a lot of difficulties with Channel 3 in Connecticut and Channel 3 in Philadelphia. Originally, that station was moved from Nevada to serve New Jersey as a commercial VHF television station in New Jersey, and it's licensed in New Jersey, and it went on the air on VHF Channel 3. Channel number, to avoid confusion, avoid complaints with Channel 3 in Philadelphia and Channel 3 in Connecticut, Channel 3, and then they added a sub-channel, 3-11, and that was supposed to avoid a confusion. These stations, these other Channel 3s are complaining that cable subscribers are going to be confused with all these Channel 3s in the area, so they branded themselves 3-10 and 3-11. Well, a couple of months ago, they were forced to go to channel, to brand themselves as channel 33, or face going off the air. And so they're still on branding themselves as channel 33-1, I believe, and 33-2. But they're still on RF3. I don't know if that's going to get cleared up. I think they're kind of hoping that they will, that they will be able to return back to branding themselves as a channel 3. You may have to rescan to get the channel back as a result of that change. K2RAW in the technical net from KD2BD.
I thank you, John. I'm going to have to do some more scanning. Rescan is something I can't do. I'm afraid to lose too many things, but I can add channels. So I wonder, Joe, have you been looking at channel 3-11 or channel 3 at all? Now, if it's really on the RF channel 3, which is, let's see, 54 to 60, 60 to 66 megahertz, WE2RYY, the guy who does a lot of over-the-air television DXing with digital television. So, have you been looking at this one, Joe? Over to you, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I watch what's on RF3 relatively frequently, but do we get over to a tangent with all this stuff, because I wanted to make a comment on something I measured on, I took some time to set up equipment to measure it, right? You've talked about interference on the digital television. What I found out is this. I took some signal generator, put it into a tap, ahead of one of my converters, and then took the output of that and split it, where one line went to the converter, one line went to back to my spectrum analyzer, so I could see what I was doing by putting a carrier in. And here's what I found out. It's interesting. If I put a carrier in that was minus 10 dB or less below the pilot carrier, that's 309 4/10 kilohertz below the bottom of the channel, I would not break up the picture. If I increase the carrier level to anything above minus 10 below that carrier level, it would start breaking up the picture quite dramatically, just on a single RF carrier, not noise impulse. I then took the same RF carrier, increased it to the same level as what you call a pilot carrier coming in, and moved it slowly across the rest of the television channel, and it caused virtually no problem with the picture. If I moved it quickly in frequency, relatively quickly, where I can move a couple of megs per second, using like a tracking mode and have it spread itself across the whole channel, then it would start causing some interference. But I found the greatest interference was having something as a CW carrier very close to a pilot carrier. That the television decoder did not seem to like at all.
I think that's darn good information, Joe, because I've had a theory, and I keep saying it to Eric, and I keep getting flack on this one, that pilot tone in my opinion, is something that your converter has to phase lock to, which sets up all the timing for the many demodulating procedures that are required to suck up all of those digital channels and all of their sub-channel numbers, dash one, dash two, dash three, and so on. So I think that pilot tone is something you've got to lock on to. And sometimes I hear a yes, and sometimes I hear a no from Eric on that one. And so I have speculated that if my converter could locally have additional information by way of a global positioning satellite receiver, disciplined, high-stability local oscillator, where I could put in an accurate pilot tone, I'd like to believe that my converter could now tolerate a lot more signal-to-noise ratio grief, impulse noise grief, and so on. And your measurement, it seems to be confirming that. So 10 dB down gives it grief there, but that same 10 dB down, other frequencies, doesn't give it grief unless it's sweeping rapidly. That would suggest...
exactly what I said.
Okay, I thought you said that when it sweeps rapidly, it created grief. If it sat still at other frequencies, it didn't create grief. I had a guess as to what that meant. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, I'll say it again. When I put a carrier, the injector carrier, at minus 10 dB or less, below the pilot carrier's level coming in, it wouldn't cause the picture to break up. If I increase it to minus 10 or above, I find this on quite a few channels, VHF and mostly UHF, it would cause the picture to break up. If I increase that RF level to the same level as the pilot carrier and then moved it elsewhere more than 50 kilohertz away from that carrier, the pilot carrier at 309.4, well, the bottom of the channel, it had virtually no effect on the picture unless I started quickly moving it in RF frequency across the 6 megahertz. That's what I said.
Okay, what you call minus 10 dB below, I'm going to call it 10 dBc. In other words, if your reference for power is the pilot tone as it's broadcast, and now your signal is 10 dB weaker than that, it's minus 10 dBc, 10 dB with reference to that carrier. And if I understand correctly, you can go close to 0 dBc as long as it's off of that carrier 309 local frequency, and the system will tolerate it if it's not moving rapidly. The fact that moving rapidly makes it intolerant suggests that there is a kind of equalization going on in your converter, that a strong local signal off of the pilot tone can be nulled in the converter's adaption process. The fact that you move it fast and it creates grief, but if you don't move it, it doesn't create grief, suggests that some kind of equalization or adaptation is taking place within your converter. That's my guess. Next time you and I talk to Eric, we got to ask him some more questions on this. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, you keep on thinking that if you lock that frequency to exactly 309.4 below the bottom of the carrier, that's the golden answer to it all. Let me tell you something. With the converter I have, I measured the frequency of the local oscillator inside the carrier, and it has a progressive error where my highest UHF channel is about 15 to 20 kilohertz higher in frequency, the LO, which means the channels are slightly shifted up because it has a little bit of an inherent local inside error inside the converter itself. That really has no effect on the picture, because higher end channels like RF44 from New York, which is channel 5, locks up fine, has no problem with it. 47, which is the one out east, has no problem with that one either. What I'm telling you about this whole thing, why I did the measurements, is because many times I've had stuff start to break up the picture, and I'll take a look at the spectrum analyzer, and there's really nothing on the picture information area of the screen. But if I listen to that RF carrier at 309.4 below the bottom end, if I listen to a special service monitor decoding in AM, if I have something else out there that's heterodyne with that carrier or starting to heterodyne with it, that causes the grief. This is why I did this measurement. I think that causes the greatest amount of grief to these things, especially having some multipath can do it, noise can do it, you're right, but I think also co-channel interference has a lot to do with it also. And with Eric making that comment about a week or two ago about them selling the top end of the band, like shaving off 900 megahertz worth of channels in the TV band. That means the highest RF channel you're going to have is going to be RF-26. Once you do that, you're going to have a real mishmash of frequencies to go around to, for everybody to try to, you know, put all this broadcasting on, and I'm not sure how that's going to actually work. So TVDX will be a thing of the past once that happens. Back to you, Dick.
As I see it, Joe, you've done something very crafty. By taking that pilot tone and listening to it with your service monitor, demodulating it with amplitude demodulation, and if you hear a tone on it, and you recognize that the picture starts breaking up, and the tone most likely is coming from co-channel interference or some other spurious source of signal getting to your environment, corrupting that quality of that pilot tone at 309.4 kilohertz. As I see it, in your local converter, that has to be a pure phase lock signal. The fact that you see 10 or 20 kilohertz of RF carrier error in the local oscillator of your converter is not that's giving us a false alarm. Let me explain that one. I'm assuming your converter has a phase lock loop that when you tell it to go to channel 33, it knows the exact frequency an LO is supposed to be on, and it programs its fractional divide circuit of its phase lock loop to go there. And assuming that your reference oscillator for your phase lock loop had perfect frequency accuracy, you would be right on spot. The slightest error in your reference oscillator means that the number of kilohertz of error of your locally generated LO is going to increase in error as you go to higher channel numbers. I've seen that taking place with my R7000, for instance. And so that carrier error, that local oscillator error, gets washed out because that makes a slight shift in the IF frequency that you get in your super heterodyne down converter. However, there is another phase lock loop I am speculating. Let me drop it. In your demodulator, at the IF frequency, there is another phase lock loop circuit that must lock itself to that pilot tone in order for all the timing, all the rest of the demodulating process to take place. So that IF strip local oscillator phase lock loop system is adaptable. He can tolerate errors in the local oscillator for the front end of your super heterodyne down converting. So if by whatever means you now generate by way of a disciplined oscillator of the using GPS disciplined oscillator, you can now make the reference oscillator of your converter perfect. Therefore, the 309.4 is going to be an exact frequency in the IF strip. Therefore, you can generate it to be perfect. And now, whether or not there's amplitude modulation or whatever on the pilot tone, no sweat. The one thing left for me to worry about, let me drop it, is that now if I locally generate a really got pure 309.4 kilohertz pilot tone, and I've got the frequency right but the phase wrong, is that tolerable? That's my real question to Eric next. In the case of a chrominance signal, the 3.579545, I could generate it with perfect frequency accuracy on an old-fashioned analog television. That ain't good enough. The whole reason why you have that 8 hertz of chrominance burst on the end of each horizontal line of an analog television set is to make sure that not only the 3.579 is exactly the right frequency, but it's got to be exactly the right phase, or Jay Leno's first phase turns green. So the one thing I don't know, and hopefully Eric can tell me, is that 309.4 kilohertz, if I've now got it on the exact right frequency compared to broadcast, but the wrong phase, will the system work? In which case, we've now got to go one step further, because the exact phase of the 309 that I get is now a function of how many wavelengths there is between that broadcast center and my receiver. And therefore, I've got to compensate for that phase with this system. But I think it's a little bit more of a challenge, but I think that's tolerable. What do you think about all this, Joe? W2LYY, K2IW, TechNet, great research.
I hear you refer to me.
Oh boy, have I been referring to you. So, if I've now got a disciplined oscillator so that my references in my houses are perfect, and therefore the reference oscillator for my phase lock loop of the local oscillator of my converter that does the count conversion to the IF, I've got it right, and now I generate a perfect 309.4 kilohertz pilot tone locally that hopefully is the exact same frequency as broadcast. The fact that my locally generated pure tone is on the right frequency but might be on the wrong phase, will the rest of the demodulation system have the right timing, and will it have a reasonably low bit error rate? Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
I'm hearing something that I think needs a little clarification. Are you referring to the pilot tone as a device that causes synchronization?
Now, what you didn't hear is that the experiment that Joe did this week is that by putting in carriers to his demodulator, he's got a signal generator, he's putting in carriers, and when he makes the carrier minus 10 dBc at the exact pilot tone frequency, 309.4 kHz, at minus 10 dBc, his demodulator is happy and keeps on cranking. When he makes it minus 9 dB, it goes bunkers. So it can tolerate 10 dB of carry-to-noise ratio on the pilot tone. However, if he now shifts that frequency away from the pilot tone frequency, somewhere else in the 6 megs, he can go all the way up to 0 dBc, and his converter keeps right on cranking with one catch. That's if it is a fixed tone. He can have close to 0 dBc, but if he is swishing it rapidly, the converter goes bonkers. That suggests that the converter has a certain amount of adaptation or equalization. It can tolerate a phony tone away from the pilot as long as it's not moving. But his greatest vulnerability of putting in a CW carrier is on the pilot tone. That seems to suggest there's something very magic about the frequency and or phase of that pilot tone in order for the rest of the demodulation process to take place correctly. That's what his test seems to indicate. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, I get you. Actually, a lot of research has been done just about that. But let me paint a little picture for you. You remember when ATSC first started, there was no pilot tone. It was put there to train the equalizer, help the equalizer get where it needs to be. And don't forget that this whole thing is asynchronous. Timing is determined by demodulation, you know, separating senescence I and Q. In APSB, you throw the Q away, and in QAM, you need it. But the way the pulses are, I'm being slow, right? The way the pulses are separated and framing is determined for clocking, to clock the whole system. It actually comes from taking and demodulating the symbols out of the HBSB. Now, come insert a pilot tone, which is in essence sitting just timed perfectly to be in between symbol space and in random number space. So, not only when you are beating up on the pilot, where you can beat the pilot, let me let it drop first. Where you can beat the pilot with a CW carrier to a certain degree, and in essence nothing happens. You reach a certain threshold, you're now banging into the symbol that lies underneath it and right next to it. So in essence you're disturbing the ability to demodulate a continuous string. How's that grab you? K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, you've given evidence of your point of view, and you're probably right, but Joe's got one other piece of evidence. On a couple of occasions, he's sure he has plenty of signal coming into his demodulator, and yet he's getting a broken-up picture. With his spectrum analyzer, he looks for the phony signal, the co-channel interference. He doesn't see anything. However, he then zeroes into the pilot tone that he's receiving over the air with his service monitor, and now he narrows up the bandwidth, listens to that pilot tone in the amplitude demodulation mode, and he hears a tone on it. In other words, something is beating with it, and when something is beating with that pilot tone as he receives it over the air, to some degree his demodulator goes bonkers. That suggests that the demodulation process only takes place correctly if the pilot tone is fairly pure, above a certain signal to noise ratio, but it's got to be fairly pure. If there's extraneous modulation on the pilot tone, his demodulator goes bonkers. So when it comes to, is the pilot tone really being used as a frequency slash timing reference? You're saying no, but something is being used for proper timing of framing and clocking. There's got to be some way that we can inject a locally disciplined oscillator to make sure that the timing is correct for framing and clocking. Maybe it's not the pilot tone, but there's got to be some other way we can put in the right frequencies to give the system greater tolerance of carrier-to-noise ratio problems and or impulse problems or multipath problems. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, what happens when you start changing taps on your equalizers? Okay. I understand what you're saying about tolerance, but let's look at another issue. All right, let's say a Smeal co-channel coming in, and you would expect it to be exactly the same frequency, exactly on top of it. Well, I'm willing to bet you if you were able to separate the two and measure, you may find some that are pretty darn close and others that miss each other completely. So, and the reason for that, oh boy, was this a mistake. I'm heading to the city to look at a transmitter and the expressway is closed. The reason for that is that some transmitters are connected to GPS trained oscillators and others are not, and they just rely on a crystal oscillator that they're making their 10 megahertz from and bringing it up. Which is generally close in most cases, not that far away. I couldn't put a number on it, but there's some differences. So, you know, it's a multitude of things. If you start moving that training signal around or disturbing it, you're then starting to change the way the taps and the equalizers are, and it's going to start getting blocking and that kind of stuff.
When Joe listened to that corrupted pilot tone in the amplitude demodulation mode of his service monitor, and he heard a amplitude modulated tone, let's assume that he heard a tone of 1 kilohertz. That tells me that the co-channel signal was in RF carrier 1 kilohertz away, or its 309.4 pilot tone was 1 kilohertz away. There was a 1 kilohertz difference between the extraneous signal and the television ATSC signal he wants to demodulate. Now, was it really a co-channel interference coming from some other place? Or was some extraneous object in his environment creating a spurious frequency that came out on the pilot tone 1 kc away? Maybe that does or doesn't make a difference. So his experiment, listening to that tone, listen to the amplitude modulation of the corrupted tone, suggests that his demodulator has a strong need for an unmodulated, clean pilot tone at 309.4 kilohertz. So that would suggest it's part of the demodulated timing process to make framing and clocking work correctly. And if not, how does the local demodulator generate those critical frequencies and phases of that clocking and demodulation process, clocking and framing? Where does that come from locally? And can we inject it with high spectral purity locally to enhance the process? Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ, K2LAW. It's getting close to this letter you're going to be writing. Go ahead, Derek.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Nice. You know, let me put it to you this way. Something tells the equalizer what to do before any demodulation can take place, right? And that's that nice, clean, very narrow pilot tone. If you look at the shape of it, it's square, actually. The funny little peak on the top of it is mathematically derived. that, tell the equalizer what to do and where to be. The equalizer has a little tune circuit that plucks that thing out and uses it as its reference to determine whether there's multitask happening or there's an early reflection or a late reflection. And it adjusts a series of taps, which are in essence delay on it. You make that jitter, okay, what's going to happen is the output stream that's coming out of the equalizer is going to be jittering and bouncing back and forth in time. When that happens, now we have problems. Remember, the stream is asynchronous, meaning that its clock information is built into the data stream. So if I disturb this data stream that's coming in, I then have a problem putting the bits in the right places because they're jumping to the left and right positions of where they should be. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, I can see that, Grief. You're telling me the data supplies the clocking reference frequencies. And that suggests that the clocking reference frequencies for framing and clocking are not necessarily directly related to that pilot. And yet still, if that pilot moves around in amplitude or phase, funny things happen. My first question, Eric, is that if I inject a pure pilot tone, and maybe it's a square wave with a little peak on top, but I get the frequency exactly right compared to broadcast frequency, but I have the phase of what I'm generating wrong. Does it have the same vulnerability as analog television did with the chrominant signal? The 3.579545 chrominant locally generated carrier, which is being locked by those 8 hertz, those 8 cycles of the burst on each horizontal sweep. If that comes out with the wrong phase, Jay Leno's face turns green. Is there an equal vulnerability here to ATSC? Does that 309.4 kilohertz pilot tone, if I got the frequency right compared to broadcast, do I have to also get the phase right? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Alright, I want to do two different things. One is, let's break a receiver down into its component parts. Right? We got a front end, we got a mixer, we get to an IF, we got the thing called an equalizer, and then we go into a to D that's broken up into ion fuel. Right? And we could, let's say, put a bypass switch on the equalizer. That's one thought. The other thing is that you have to... Well, let me ask you this question first. Have you ever used an arbitrary waveform generator, a waveform generator that you could draw the wave shape and have it come out?
Yeah, some of the companies I work for, they call them an ARP. Arbitrary waveform generator. And by the way, this equalizer you're talking about, I am guessing it is a sophisticated form of a so-called transversal filter. In other words, there's a delay line with a whole bunch of taps. And if each one of those taps, I can adjust the amplitude and phase. In other words, I can make it a positive or a negative signal, and I can adjust the amplitude on each of those taps. And now the output of all of those taps, I sum them correctly. And if I got enough intelligence in the way I work that circuit, I can do a hell of a lot of equalizing and echo suppression and all kinds of good things. Is that essentially what's going on with the equalizer in these digital demodulators? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Essentially, yes. But I kind of lied a little bit because I put the equalizer in the analog part of it, whereas really in the digital part of it after the bits get separated from one another. But it gets its information from the RF portion of the... It actually gets from a filter that sucks the pilot out. Anyway, the point was is that the pilot that you see, okay, is not generated by an oscillator injected in it. It's part of the waveform. It's generated mathematically. Right? And its relationship to the rest of the positions of the rest of the stuff, as opposed to just the frequency, is absolutely important. If you shift it left or right, you're now cluttering up some other symbols, which is going to make your demodulated material look awful. So, the concept of trying to take a frequency generator and replace that thing is a nice thought, but are you going to stick it in the right place? Is it exactly that frequency? Is it slightly to the left, slightly to the right? Are the edges exactly in the right place? Does it have the right rise time on each side, etc.?
Okay, that pilot tone you're saying is not a injected oscillator at the broadcast center. It is a, what's the word for it? It's an artifact. The modulation process generates that as a kind of a sophisticated artifact, an intentionally generated artifact. Okay. Therefore, if all of the timing circuits of my local demodulator also generate that same artifact at the right frequency, maybe in the right phase, then I know that my local timing is good, and as long as the broadcast center is disciplined in its timing circuits, and if my demodulator is also disciplined with its timing circuits, do I come out ahead? Do I have now less vulnerability to impulse noise and multipath signals giving me inter-symbol distortion? Do I have less vulnerability if I've in a sophisticated way done local timing that creates that beautiful pilot tone artifact? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, okay. You have to define what less vulnerability is. Because if something comes along and disturbs a signal, a symbol, and makes this symbol disappear, you're very good, you know, an artifact. I mean, if you're talking about vulnerability of the receiver completely unlocking, and you have to wait for it to come back, that's another story, okay? You know, because of the shape of the damn thing, you know, looking at it on a spectrum analyzer is somewhat deceiving in a certain sense, because you can't actually see the energy that's being created. You're looking across the frequency domain. But yeah, if you could duplicate that, fit it exactly on top of it, but what's the point? That doesn't have the synchronization in it. That simply tells the equalizer how to behave and be a good boy.
Eric, I'm living in house number 51. Okay. In other words, my wife and I looked at 51 houses spread over 2 years before I finally found a house that has enough land, high enough altitude, enough trees to put up my towers and be hidden from the neighbors or whatever. So I'm in a desirable location, but I'm only 30 miles from New York City. I should be getting a gangbuster signal as I was in the analog days. Now each one of my channels, 5% of the time, CBS disappears, 5% of the time, NBC disappears, 5% of the time, PIX disappears. I've never seen Channel 13 or Channel 20. Well, I've seen Channel 13 disappear. Never seen Channel 21 disappear. So each one of these, under certain weather conditions or whatever, the multipath or whatever, will make them disappear. This vulnerability to the system where my not very well equalized down converter, let me drop it, has a vulnerability where it goes bonkers and loses all synchronization, and I have to wait for everything to come back. I don't think I'd have to wait for everything to come back. I'm willing to tolerate artifacts. I'm willing to have glitches in the picture that walk around in the picture, similar to the ghosts I used to have if I had multipath with analog. I'm willing to have some artifacts, but to have the converter completely go bonkers, where it loses everything, no audio and no picture, and just a sign across the screen saying weak signal, and it takes a, and even when I know what's generating a strong local signal occasionally that gives me bonkers, and when that signal goes away, I have to wait a significant amount of time for everything to relock up, like 3 or 4 seconds. So I know that all of this complete loss and or waiting time for lockup, I'm convinced that I believe that would go away if I could have all of my timing generated locally in synchronization for what's taking place at broadcast. Am I naive on that one? I mean, this email that you and I have talked about, this letter that you're going to write, are we barking up the wrong tree, or is there a potential advantage there? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
It's RWK2J. As we have discussed previously, there's a rather simple solution to that, but of course, you know, you now increase the cost of this whole system. Like, we know we have the high-end people who would be willing to pay for it. I'm not sure the manufacturers, you know, would like that idea, or not like that idea, but I've actually talked to a few people about this. You know, synchronizing the stream that's coming out, putting a little bit of data there that lets you figure out how far away you are so you can set the phase of it correctly, and having both the source of the exciter, by the way, the pilot's put in by the exciter, and having the exciter clock, GPS, having the ASI stream or the B10M stream come into the exciter, synchronized or reclocked with the GPS clock, and having at the receiver side a GPS clock that either sees those little bits that we add to train it, or there's any number of ways of making it all phase in, just by looking at the framing of the pulses coming in. So then you have that issue solved. But there's a much simpler solution to this, and that's to go into the software of the receiver and make it never mute, so you see it reassembling itself.
Okay, you're telling me I got the equivalent of a squelch circuit in there, and I can turn down the squelch, so to speak. Turn up the squelch, you know what I mean? I think there's more than that going. Right now, I lose audio and I lose video. I lose audio first, the video stays there for a while, and eventually I lose video. So I know that some portion of the demodulation process is going bonkers. And just giving me a corrupted signal, edibly corrupted signal, because everything is not synchronized, that's not good. That's not good enough. I still want to believe that locally generated disciplined timing can give me an advantage. Yes, at first, to do all that as you and I are describing it is going to be expensive. It's only a matter of time before somebody comes up with the large integrated circuit. The chip will do it very inexpensively downrange. That cell phone that's in your pocket right now, it's got 10 times the computer that NASA had on the Apollo mission that landed Neil Armstrong on the moon. So by 1969 standards, what's in your pocket is $10 million. And you bought it for a hell of a lot less than that. So, yes, it's going to be expensive at first, but if the advantage is there, if somebody's willing to build a chip, it will become cheap, in my opinion, Eric. It's just a matter of somebody making the leap of faith to say, yeah, this is worth pursuing. That's my belief. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I hear you. You know, don't forget, we recently had the discussion about APS-C 3.0 and the possible change of the whole transition. And as to how it ever actually winds up and how the manufacturers choose to implement it, but yeah, your point is 100% valid. You know, we used to be able to watch analog TV. If you could see something, you were there. It didn't matter if you had three of the same pictures across the screen, but you could watch it. And as far as the sound going away first, you seem to forget that because of doing the inverse DCT, you have to actually store a bunch of frames. The picture runs out after the sound runs out, but it also depends upon where it is in the stream and at what point the timing got broken. Q2 RIWK,
so, with what we know now, we don't have the whole picture for sure. Is there a potential advantage of disciplined local timing and disciplined broadcast time?
The answer to that is yes.
Okay. How expensive is it going to be to add it experimentally? If you had enough test points on the motherboard of a television receiver today, do you, Eric, have the knowledge as to what to add where to make this modification? Could you and I do it? I didn't say we're going to. Could you and I do it if we were sufficiently enthusiastic and we had the right kind of laboratory equipment that you and I have access to? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
And if you had an unlimited pot of gold, because there's some licenses that would have to be bought in order to even play with it, yeah, it could be done. but it also means we need someone that's really well experienced in VHDL, because if we were to build this stuff like that on a bread